So welcome. A Slack client in Rust, and the talk is coined client in general, but specifically in Rust. So I'm Matthias. I work at Trivago in Düsseldorf. I'm interested in Rust, just like you. This is and usually I talk more about my failures than about my success because let's be honest. I mean, it's a simple thing, and let's not make a big deal out of it. But still, I think it's interesting to look at the project itself and also about the motivation. So maybe you've heard about Trivago before, but the idea is that per month, and they generate around about 3 billion requests, and that's a lot of data, and that's a lot of services, and you kind of want to manage all those services automatically. And on the other side, all of those 1,200 employees, and the number is just growing and growing. We currently have 30 to 50 people per week. All of them are using Slack. So you might say, on the one side we have all of those services, and on the other side we have the Slack communication as some kind of global channel where everybody is talking to everybody. And what else to do than writing bots for chat ops? Maybe you want to tell this client to deploy something, or to give you some metrics or some monitoring, or to even having a personal agent where you say, okay, I don't want to be interrupted at that time. Please handle all the messages and do some natural language processing on that and find out if the message is really interesting, and only then send it to me directly. Otherwise, handle it yourself, for example. So that would be kind of cool. Of course, collecting metrics. For example, how many messages do we do per day? That would be interesting. How many users are there logged in at Carnival? Stuff like that. Also clone alien dinosaurs and have fun. The basic motivation is always to have fun. So before we start, let's look at Slack itself. What is it, and why is it so important for us? Here's some graph about the daily active users. And this was from 2014. And you can see that the number is just increasing. In 2014, they had 50,000 users at the end. And now, at the end of 2015, it went up to 500,000. Here you can still see a little dip when the holiday animation for 2016. So in 2016, no, actually it was 2015, it went up to 2 million. For the next year. And also I failed. So the only thing I got was this. So now we are at 4 million users, and that's really, really a high number. And if you say, also other services have this growth, I don't think so, because this chart shows you the number of years it took a big company to go to a 1 billion valuation. And only took 1.25 years to go to an evaluation of 1 billion. So, for example, you have some others on the list, Groupon, which was the biggest growing company at the beginning. Then you have Pinterest, Tinder, Uber. Uber took 3 years to get there. Trivago is also a unicorn, so currently valued at 4 billion. But Slack is super close. They have around about 3.8 billion now as a valuation. So for me, it was obvious that we need something like this. I think that we don't want to switch the chat system in the next couple months or years, so why not invest in that? So the idea was to create a Slack bot. But to create a Slack bot, you need a Slack client. There's no way around it. So you could have any language, but of course, since I'm kind of interested in Rust, why not write one in Rust? There was one in Rust, and I didn't like it. So here's an example of how to call the old Slack client. You might say, it's not that. Whatever it is, actually it's kind of stringy typed. You have a client that you hand into a method as a borrow. Then you have some kind of test token, which is just a string. And then you provide the data, the actual parameters for your method. And this is the rest of the stuff. But if you look at it, you need to pass, every time you do a request, you need to pass those two things, which always stay the same. And on the other side, you have all of those nonce here. Why? I mean, they are not semantic. They don't express any value. You need to remember which ones are where. If you mix them up, then you have a compile error or so. That's kind of frustrating for the user. And when I looked at that first, I was kind of confused. So I thought, what could be improved here? So first of all, there was no documentation. If you wanted to know how it really worked, basically you needed to look into the source code. It was not idiomatic. So it did not feel rustic or ergonomic or in any way what you might expect from a good client library. There were no tests. So one thing that I like is coming from a Python background were the libraries in Python. So for example, I'm a big fan of the requests library. I think it's a very idiomatic Python library. So I wanted to make it as idiomatic as possible and really focus on the strength of Rust. So my idea was simple. What if I create a Slack client in the beginning? So before we talk about how I did it, you need to talk about the most obvious thing in every talk. The goals. I don't know if you can read this, but what it says is great ergonomics. It should be easy to use. It should feel like a real Rust client, not something that you wrote for another language and ported it. It should be idiomatic. It should be fully documented and tested. It should have solid error handling, not throw some generic error. It should convert from JSON to some semantic types, so real Rust types, not some thingy JSON type thing that you need to. And it should implement the full Slack API, so all the methods. All of those goals to bring me to the topics of this talk. I will keep it short. I could talk about all of those points and 100 more for hours. But I don't want to. So I will just stick to those five things that I want to talk about. The first thing is I want to tell you a little bit about the builder pattern, what it is, and why it's kind of cool in this case. Then I want to tell you a little bit about testing. I will use a library called Yup Hypermock for that. Then error handling with types with Surdy. And implementing the full Slack API with a JSON schema. So coming to the first point would be the builder pattern. So you have two libraries. One is do it yourself, which is not really a library. You need to really do it yourself. And the other one is derived builder, which is written by people in this room. Can somebody bring in? Well, actually, meet up in.
You did it because you erase
Yeah, that was the initial ignition, was that I had this problem. Funnily, I still have this problem. Because there's this issue open, and it can only be solved with macros 2.0, as far as I understood. This is also very, very fresh. Basically, what it means is you have some internal data, some internal struct in Rust, and you want to handle it with some wrapper struct. And exactly this situation I have in my client, because I have some kind of builder pattern with a lot of options for the parameters, and on the other side I have a client. And this client needs to take the arguments from the user and write a builder for the internal struct. So I don't know if we find a solution for that. I hope so. In the meantime, you can write it yourself. So it's not that hard, but it's a lot of writing and a lot of busy work. But you can do it. Now here comes a horrible slide with horrible formatting, and everybody's looking at the slides now. Like everybody wants to see this. But you can probably not read it, and it's fine. It's just about the high-level overview. Basically, what you need to do is you have a struct with some options. And for example, that would be one Slack method here. And it has a couple parameters, like channel, latest, oldest, and so on. And then you have this in some kind of struct. And the optional parameters are specified with an option. So you don't need to set them. They are, as I said, optional. And then you have some kind of new function to create one with the default values. So the default for option would be none. There is no parameter set. And then once you have all of this built, then you can do something fancy with it. Here you have the builder. And the builder just generates an object of the type that you have defined for your parameters. So this builder will generate an object of a client and the history options that we saw before. So that is really cool, because then you have some very idiomatic way of writing your code. You will see later how that looks like. But if you write something like this, it's very tricky to handle all the error situations. So the next thing I want to talk about is error handling. It's kind of tricky. In the beginning, when you read about error handling, you might read it from the book, and it's a long chapter, and I don't think that I can reproduce everything that's on there. But the idea is that you, for example, implement some error type, and you can have a description for your error, and you can have what was the other thing? A description and a longer description. I don't know. But for every error that you define yourself, you can implement this trait. And then it gives you a lot of semantics to convert between your own error and other errors from other people. And it's a long list of things that you can do here. And basically, if you write everything out, then you see something like this on the left. And on the right, there's a library for this. But first, let's go to the left. You cannot read it, but it's very, very longish. That's what you should get from this. And you need to implement all of those traits and all of those implementations for your own error types to make them standard compatible. So on the right side, there's exactly the same. And it's a bit more readable. And I will increase it a little bit, the size. So this is all you need to write if you have error handling for your client. Let's say you write a Slack client, that would be one start, one way to think about it. You have own errors, which are in those error curly braces, and then you have foreign links, which are usually language-specific errors that were defined in the standard library. And you can convert between those two. And the nice thing is that this will happen automatically. You don't need to care about this anymore. Error handling becomes second nature. Once you have this set up, all of the other stuff will be generated for you. So I can highly recommend ErrorChain or QuickError, which is an alternative. But I kind of like ErrorChain a bit more because it's a bit more flexible. Because the wording ErrorChain indicates that you can chain errors. And what you can do is, for example, you want to open a file and it cannot be opened, then there will be an I/O error, for example, and causing an own error of your own type. So basically, there will be two errors. And with ErrorChain, you can chain those two together. And the user will see, OK, an I/O error happened. And because of this, an own type error happened. For example, a Slack client I/O error happened. And you can chain all of that. There's a lot of libraries that use ErrorChain. And whenever somebody is using ErrorChain, you get all of this for free. You just need to specify that you want to handle those errors, and the conversion happens automatically. So as an example, no real specifics, but on the top was what I had before. So maybe you have an error in the conversion from some JSON to some internal type, and the error will be handled with this map error. But the problem is you lose error information because ErrorChain says nothing about what really happened. And as a user, that's kind of a very bad experience. And contrary to that, you see below what happens with ErrorChain. You can simply say, OK, this error can happen. And if it happens, then chain it with my own type, saying unable to convert response body to a Slack type. That's much more idiomatic for a user. He knows, okay, something happened during the conversion, and he gets the internal standard library error. Another example, a bit more involved. First thing you see on the top right, you don't need to specify result response error. You only need to specify result response, because the error type will always be your own error. And this is already defined by ErrorChain. So you don't even need to think about how to define it. And your code gets a lot more easy to read because you cannot mix it up. You always have a result of something. And then the old one was kind of strange with all this matching and so on. That was the best I could do. I got a lot of help to get this running from Colin. But after that, with ErrorChain, what you can do is you can again chain your error. What you could also do is you could simply add a question mark behind read to string here. On the first plus line, you can say read to string something body and question mark. That would be the caret, and it would send the error to the caller, which is very, very helpful, and that all happens automatically for you. So. Nice improvement. Throughout my library, all of that was a big reduction in code and duplicate code. Now, the tricky part is you have those error types defined, you have your interface defined, and now you want to know if it really works. So what you could do is every time you go to the Slack API, you run your requests, you do real I/O, real network traffic, but the problem is that it's slow and it's error prone, because what happens if the Slack server is down or your connection is flaky? You get flaky tests. So I was looking for a solution for that, and I wrote it in specifically in very, very small letters here so that you cannot read it, but it says yup hypermock, and that's a way to mock the HTTP client from the real test. For example, in the top, you can define that every request to https://slack.com will go to the fixtures that you defined. And this fixture is simply an HTTP response that is coming from the real Slack documentation. And then you can use this fixture in your test without specifying anything. You just say client. And then you give it a connector, a with connector, and you see that the Slack request from above is passed into the client. And this is a way to mock away any network traffic and so on. So you always get a reproducible result. And the result of this client request looks like this below. So it's a real semantic Rust type. It's a vector of messages which has real fields that you can match on. It feels very rustic. And this is also how you use the client. So you create a client, usually without a connector, and then you run some method like im underscore history, which is a Slack method, and with some parameters, and you write send, and you get the response. So all of this that you see here, try to remember the syntax here of the Rust types. I can show you now in the browser. And first of all, latest is here. That's a parameter we set. We set with latest. And you can set this parameter here. And the response is down below. So that looks oddly similar to what we saw before. But this is a JSON. And this is the Rust representation. You could go as far as saying you cannot write an invalid request. Every request you send is always valid. You cannot mix up the data types. You cannot change the order of parameters. You can check the URLs that you send, and so on. Pretty cool. But do you want to write all of that yourself? Probably not. Why? Well, I tried to copy all the methods of the Slack API on one slide. It looks a bit like this. You would have to implement all of this for every of those methods. Oh, actually, here's some more. That's a lot. I mean, I don't consider myself too lazy, but that's even too much for me. So whenever I see something like this, and somebody comes over and says, yeah, you need to implement all of that, please. And if something changes, then please fix it. I have some, I get some weird dreams, let's say. This is not feasible. We need some smarter way to do it. So how about that? We generate all of that ourselves. So the idea was to have some kind of Slack client create, which has a so-called build RS file. Build RS runs before your compile step, and it can do everything. It can get the resource from the internet, it can create files, it can write code. And this is what we use it for. So this main Rust create, it will call some kind of code generation build RS script. But the build RS script in reality calls another code gen Slack library. Why? Because you don't need to recompile it every time, so it's super fast. And all of the code generation stuff is in another crate, but it can be in the same repository. So the only thing is you trigger it once, it will generate all the code, and then the real Slack client will compile the code and check if it's valid. But this code gen thing has no idea of the Slack API. As you saw, it's just a HTML file, and they have no real documentation for that. Fortunately, there was some guy who had this Slack API ref on GitHub, and it's written in Ruby. Okay, so you run one rake command, and it will fetch all those HTML files, and it will generate. It will run through the Slack client, and it will generate all of those specifications for you. So a specification looks a bit like this. Let's go for the method that we saw already, im history. So that is the specification. Oh, somebody knows how to scroll. View. No, actually. I thought
zoom out at the bottom.
Huh?
This is zoom in and out at the bottom.
Oh, I clicked on Zoom.
Actually, the other way.
Yeah. Ah, okay. That's kind of awkward. It takes a while. I guess that's big enough. Thanks. Every method has a group. Every method has a name, a description, the arguments, if it's a required argument or not, and all of that stuff we need for code generation. So pretty much what we want. Once we use that, the way it looks like is that this build script, it will first... actually, the code generation also has error chain built in, so you can also see the errors here. It will get the schema, create some internal Slack types that we provide, and then for each method, it will write some file to somewhere, to some out directory of the build script, and then from there it's copied to the source folder. And now the scary part is, you've seen before how this nice builder looks once you write it yourself, but if you want to make it more general, then it looks a bit like this here. So this is written with a template library that I kind of like. I can only recommend it to you. It's called Terra. And Terra is Django-like. So it's probably very familiar to you. You have those arguments and so on. And you can pass in every Slack type. And if you do that for the, you can pass in any Rust type. And if you do it for the Slack API, you can go through and render all of that. There's some to-dos here that I will come to later, but for the most part, it will just take what you pass it in, for example, a method, which has some certain definition, and the definition is exactly here. The method for each Slack method, the method type is looking like this. Yes, and we need all of that, and there's some kind of helpers in there, but for the most part, we just render it out one-to-one with this code generation part here. For example, here, we render the functions for the builder for each optional argument. And then you can, for example, say, with latest, blah, blah, blah. All of this is generated here. Maybe you're now asking, okay, why aren't you using procedural macros? Well, because I think I'm more used to that kind of syntax. And also, I don't know how to express that in procedural macros, if it's easier or not, given that there's no AST library, which is stable yet. And so I went with this. The advantage is that all of this is running on stable Rust. So with the procedural macro release lately, you can do all of this magic, all of this deriving and so on in stable Rust, which is really cool. Yeah, okay, I'm almost done. Now the result looks something like this. You have a client, you hand in a new token, and then you can call the methods. For example, if you want to call im.history, so instant messaging.history, you say im underscore history in your client. Simple enough. You give it some parameters and you click send. Alternatively, if you want to be a bit more specific, Tim gave me the hint to do it a better way. Some prefer this way of writing it, where you have a struct and you write the parameters yourself. The advantages of that is that maybe you can pre-generate your requests somewhere, and then you only need to run them at runtime. And all of this can be somewhere else and can be run multiple times. Yeah, cool. And once you run this request, the response looks like this. I guess you've seen it before. you get some IAM history result with the messages in the right types. So what did I learn? Doing anything right is hard. And doing anything right takes time. You might say, okay, come on, it's a client for some API. It can't be that hard. I can write it in Bash. Well, for sure you can. But if you want to write one which is actually not that shitty and is well documented and tested and so on, you need to invest some time. And especially the more simple it looks, usually the harder it is to implement. That was just my experience. Let's talk a little bit about the outlook. What is missing? I would love to support the real-time Slack API. Slack has another API which is based on events. And you could start a long-running process and it would listen to some event bus and would react on that. So that would be amazing to also include it. I'm planning to do that. Then I need to convert all the remaining Slack types. So for example, one thing would be cool to have a Slack emoji crate that has rendered all the emojis that are there in Slack. And then you can use it from within Rust. Kind of fancy. Also, timestamps could use a chrono for having a semantic type system. Yeah, iterators for pagination. Sometimes you get a response back with a field saying has more equals true. That means that there's more results that you can query on. And it would be nice to have some kind of iterator over that. So you don't need to call has more with the next parameters. You just say, give me all the responses until the iterator is exhausted. That would be really fancy. And also proper int conversions. I'm using strings and int 64s and float 64s right now. Would be nicer to have something like int string. Then you could pass in whatever you want, for example, static strings or anything that can be converted to a string with the from trait. That would be really fancy as well. And whatever you do, one thing you need to remember, and that's the only takeaway I can give you. There's some people out there that can give you a lot of hints on how to write a proper one, proper client for your own use. So I can only recommend to you to read Pascal's blog, because he has a much better listing of all the things you can do with elegant APIs in Rust, and it's gigantic. And once you do all of this, everything else will come naturally. Yeah, so what is left to do is showing you the kind of status of the rendering. The current status is here. The stuff that is different here is different from the one that I generated myself, the one that I wrote myself and the one that I generated. So there's some differences still. For example, maybe you can't read it. Here I automatically add comments to every field. The formatting is kind of a bit off sometimes. Like here, there's some weird formatting stuff. Okay, we can work with that. That looks more confusing than it is in reality. In here, the only difference is that I'm using int string here in my version that I wrote, and here I'm using a hard string. Some default types were missing. I changed from with latest to latest because I heard that that's the more idiomatic way. Also, the tests are still missing. So auto-generating the tests is something that I need to do. That's kind of the status quo. And thanks so far. Any questions? You need the microphone. I wanted to open source the version today. Given the fact that I don't have the test generated already, I want to postpone it. Actually, if you think about it, I should maybe just open source it and then develop it in the open, because then people could also help me. But I'm doing this as kind of a learning experience, so I kind of want to have it ready, at least some tests, so that people can start contributing and not me doing the same mistakes that others did already. So it's kind of, right now, it would not provide much value over the one we already have without tests. That's at least how I see it. But yeah, the release is right on the edge, right on the verge.
So now we know how to write a Slack bot, but what would your bot actually do?
There's one fancy idea and one not so fancy idea. So one thing that my bot would probably do would be to monitor who's in the office. It sounds more scary than it is, but I want to correlate it with our other metrics that we have. For example, how many rollbacks do we need to do? I have the suspicion that the less people are in the office, the better we do. But it's kind of a funny thing. And the more serious topic would be that you have some kind of smart, I'm not available bot. Right now in Slack you can have I'm not available, and then if you write somebody, then he will get a message, oh, this guy doesn't want to be disturbed right now. Do you really want to send him this message, or should I send it to him once he's done? Once he can be interrupted? And it's kind of stupid because it has no context. And so my idea was to have some kind of natural language processing on the request, the question that was asked, actually the text. And based on that, I can decide if I want to let my bot answer with some kind of link to the documentation or some kind of very generic answer, did you try that? Or if I really want to act. Yeah. Okay then. Thanks for listening.